Welcome everyone to our November Roundtable Expert Q&A call with Cassie Erkins, author of Instructional Agility and Collaborative Common Assessments, both of which we have previously discussed on Principal Center Radio. And our purpose in convening this roundtable today is to go deeper and to talk about some of the organization-wide issues that we encounter when implementing systems and strategies and guidance that we get from Cassie's books. So as a starting point, I want to encourage you to go back and listen to the Principal Center Radio podcast episodes that we've done previously. You can find those at principalcenter.com, and I will provide links to those later as well. And of course, I want to refer you to the books. And the books are kind of a great way to explain what Cassie does. So Cassie is an internationally renowned author and expert on assessment, one of the architects of the Solution Tree Assessment Center, one of the architects of really all of the professional development that Solution Tree does. And Cassie's written a number of books with Tom Shimmer, Nicole Vogley, and other experts, and really has been close to the work of professional learning communities that Solution Tree and, of course, the schools around the world have been doing over the past 20 years. So, Cassie, with all of that, it's my pleasure to welcome you to the roundtable. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Justin. It's great to be with you.
Well, I'm so excited to talk about assessment because, you know, we're at a point where I almost feel like the pendulum has swung as far as it was going to swing in one direction. I don't know if I should make that prediction, but I do feel like we're in kind of a backswing toward a little bit of a more reasonable point. I became a principal at what I would consider kind of the height of the accountability movement when there was a very serious effort to tie compensation, to tie principal evaluation, to tie teacher compensation and teacher evaluation to test scores. You know, we were probably doing the maximum amount of high stakes testing we had ever done in this country. And I think that poisoned a generation, if I could use such a strong word, poisoned a generation of educators and certainly of parents and students as well toward assessment in some ways. The like just some of the extremes that we saw, some of the the maybe ill-conceived plans and schemes that we came up with as a profession really gave assessment a little bit of a bad name and a bad rap. And I wonder if you've encountered any of that. I don't want to dwell in the negative, but I do want to just kind of acknowledge that elephant in the room as we get into talking about everything that is wonderful and amazing and powerful about assessment. I don't know, what have you seen in that regard?
Oh, I completely agree with you, Justin. I think that 30-year history of high-stakes testing across multiple bodies of legislation that was accepted by both Republican and Democratic parties, right? So you talk about Goals 2000, No Child Left Behind, and so on. And we can see that there's been this long history of what you're talking about. And as a result, schools tried to get themselves ready and compensate. So they created things like pacing guides that you had to implement with fidelity and research-based curriculums that you had to follow carefully and only do that. And as a result, teachers, I think today, struggle to figure out how do I assess? It's been taken out of their hands and they just default to something else. And so not only are parents and students poisoned to it, but sometimes teachers have a very negative response. So when I talk about assessment, their first word is test. And they don't see it as this fluid, ongoing way of teaching and gathering good information.
And it's almost like we don't even see assessment as a verb at all. We see assessment as a noun, a thing that your district purchases and that they hand you, or, you know, there's an online thing and then you have to have your students log into it. Like the sense of what an assessment or what assessment actually is, I think has gotten buried in a lot of those pendulum swings and extreme policies that we've had over the last 20 years. So reclaiming assessment. I know, like, you and everyone at the Solution Tree Assessment Center and the schools that you work with never lost that, you know, that heart of assessment. It was, you know, the broader society, the broader profession that was engaged in some of those extremes. But you define assessment as something very interesting. I came across this definition twice in the book, and you say it both ways in Collaborative Common Assessments. You say, assessment is teaching, and teaching is assessment. What do you mean by that?
It's really impossible to keep moving forward with your instruction if you don't know how it's being received by the students. So while masterful teachers are teaching, they're always gathering emerging evidence and they're trying to make an informed decision about their next maneuver. And so for you to be a teacher, you have to be assessing as you're going. And vice versa, assessment is teaching, because as students gather that information, they start to make instructional decisions on their own. What do I need to do next as well? How do I get better at this task that you are asking me to do, or this thing that you are asking me to learn?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think about the, you know, the idea of, you know, monitoring and adjusting, the idea of knowing what objectives I want my, you know, students to master, and then, you know, teaching directly with those in mind, and, you know, hopefully getting all students to them. I've had a couple of conversations with people who were in Madeline Hunter's teacher education program when Madeline Hunter was a teacher educator, you know, many, many years ago. And it's funny to see that, you know, that broadly as a profession, we're coming back around to realize some of those things that again got buried by, I think, other fads, and have continued to of course work all this time, but now we're kind of rediscovering them as a profession. And I wonder, as we think about this idea of mastery and of making sure that all students are learning what we want them to learn, a big piece that has been added to the conversation in the last, I don't know, maybe 10 years especially, is around intervention and RTI. And something that you say early on in the book that really caught my eye is that when we get this right, when we know very clearly, we agree on what we want students to learn and be able to do, and then we design the assessment for how we're going to ensure that they, you know, have learned those skills and that knowledge. When we start there and then teach with all of that in mind, intervention becomes a less, you know what I mean? Like I feel like intervention has kind of just started to drive the bus in a lot of schools and districts. You know, we talk about the number of students in tier one, tier two, tier three. Talk to us about that a little bit.
So we've gotten so far away from really understanding the assessment pathway and what it's supposed to accomplish that, first of all, our pacing guides are set up by unit one, test done, unit two, test done, unit three, test done. We get to the end and we ask for some kind of a summative for the quarter or the semester, and kids have lost all the information from unit one. So they don't actually get a semester to grow in their knowledge and skills. They get a couple weeks. And we know that learning doesn't happen like that. So if a teacher was very clear about this is the end goal by the end of the semester, and I had just a couple key rubrics that I used repeatedly, and even in math, can I justify my mathematical thinking? Can I explain my mathematical reasoning and so on? So if we had a couple key rubrics and kids got to rehearse over time, that would, number one, help. But number two, if a teacher was very clear and they knew how each in every single practice piece, whether it's a homework or a question that you ask during instruction, whatever it is, how it feeds into this summative, like how is this going to get the kid ready for this and so on, and can they get better between their homework practice pieces? I can't tell you the number of times today that I sit down with teams K-12, all disciplines, and we still keep giving practice work, but we're not clear ourselves as teachers about two things. Number one, how does that practice specifically help a kid get ready by the time they get to the next assessment? And number two, what does mastery look like? Because it's not points acquired. And so if we were more sophisticated about this, we could reduce the number of kids who need intervention on the other side of the event, that summative moment.
Yeah, well, thinking about you know, what mastery looks like, and you know, can we get all students to proficiency? I think one thing that I want to point out, just because you live in this world and it may be shocking that other people have other perspectives that are out there, I have recently encountered a very strong and persistent belief that there should be score spread in a, you know, especially in a secondary school, that there should be a distribution of grades, that if we're giving too many A's, then that means we're not being rigorous enough. And I think that's really interesting from a mastery perspective, that perception is out there that, like, we shouldn't have too many A's, right? Like, and you talk a little bit about kind of grading on the curve, or that idea of, you know, we don't want to have too many A's. What are you seeing?
Well, as long ago as 1968, Benjamin Bloom was talking about the notion that if teaching is to move the needle and we tolerate that random distribution, then we haven't actually moved the needle. So are we doing our jobs? And I quote him all the time because way back then, I think he had it right. And so our job is to get kids to high levels. And rigor isn't defined by some kids can't. Rigor is defined by did we set that task at a level of cognitive complexity that made all kids think deeply? And are we challenging them beyond right and wrong answers? So we need to redefine how we're perceiving rigor to be. And we do need to get all kids set up for high levels of success because the truth is, whether we like it or not, these are the kids who are going to run the world that you're still going to retire into. They're going to take over politics. They're going to take over your medical profession. And we need them to be top-notch, all of them. So we have to get beyond that bell curve, which, by the way, was a random distribution process that was determined by dice. So we have to get beyond that and labeling humans and into that J curve, getting all kids to high levels.
Yeah, I think that's such a key understanding that we design our standards, we design our curriculum so that we get that J curve, so that almost everybody, almost all of the time, is getting everything that we want them to get. Rachel's saying in the chat here, Rachel's a director of learning for a charter school. We assess against standards and we give levels of mastery for each standard. I notice our teachers really struggle with the idea of fair is not always equal when it comes to reassessing students formatively. If we are developing a standard, then there should be additional assessment opportunities to show growth and to inform teacher instruction. So I think that's a thank you, Rachel, for that comment there. Cassie, do you want to comment on that? And then I've got a follow-up question
Yeah,
for
Rachel,
you.
I couldn't agree with you more. If you take the word again apart, again means a gain. And I think we have to stop thinking about kids getting second chances and it's not fair and start thinking about two things. Number one, there's nothing more inequitable than teaching than treating everybody as equal. But number two is that notion that if I do it again and kids got to higher levels of success, then it's a gain for me, the teacher, too. So kids get a second chance and I get a second chance to get kids to high levels. I think sometimes when I frame it that way for the audiences with whom I work, they kind of relax a little bit and they're like, you're right. It would mean we were more successful if we got more kids to high levels. So we need to stop worrying about whether or not it's just the kids getting a second chance.
Well, I know that second chance question comes up a lot when it comes to getting it full effort out of kids the first time, and we don't really want, especially if you're doing kind of a pretest post-test thing, and like there's a lot of concern from teachers that if there is a second chance or multiple opportunities to demonstrate mastery, that everybody will just kind of drag their feet and wait until their last possible opportunity to put forth enough effort to really show mastery. Does that happen in real life?
All the time, and it's a flaw in our assessment system. It's not the kid issue because even adults take the path of least resistance, right? So we're prone to procrastinate and so on and do the minimum amount that we might need to do. Kids are no different than us. So if our assessment system was balanced and healthy, then we would walk in and we would say to our kids, up front, hey, you guys, welcome to Unit 3. Here are our six learning targets. If you master these six targets on information literacy, then by the time we get to the end of this unit, you get to be part of the team that puts together the Schoolhouse Rock video on fake versus real news. And if it's a good video, we'll show it in the hallways during passing time. Throughout our instruction, I'm going to have you be monitoring and tracking your readiness target by target as we go. And by the time we get to the end, you'll want to do this activity, right? But if you don't, there's skin in the game. I will reassess, but you're going to have to do some learning, some goal setting in between those. It's not just I'm going to come back in and take the test a second time and now I might study for it. You got to do some extra work. Even if you want to go from the A minus to the A, that's great because I'm all about learning, but you got to put some skin in the game here. So let's talk about what you need to improve, set a goal, and do some extra work to qualify yourself to retake those pieces you need to retake.
I love it, the skin in the game, and I think you mentioned there that like we all do that. We all procrastinate. We all take action when we need to. And if really there is no reason to put forth the effort to demonstrate mastery earlier on, yeah, I mean we shouldn't hold kids. We shouldn't accuse kids of having character flaws that just reflect what it, how all
Good way to
humans
frame it.
behave there. So thinking about revision and multiple opportunities to demonstrate learning, one of the charts you have in the book that I think is maybe not directly related to revision, but related to kind of a cycle of formative and summative observation. You say this is kind of intended to be a kind of a qualitative indicator, but the assessment system example of formative and summative throughout the year. We're talking in this book about collaborative common assessments, so not just what one teacher does within their classroom, but a regular system. You know, you've got the annual, probably federally mandated or state mandated standardized testing. You've got maybe district benchmarks that occur maybe fall, winter, spring. And then you've got building and team developed common assessments that really kind of stitch all of this together. Let's talk about that. And of course, as an individual teacher, you do lots of things to assess. Teaching is assessing. So on an ongoing basis, you're assessing where your students are. But let's talk about that middle layer that kind of links it all together of building and team collaborative common assessments. What does that process look like for teams to develop and use those throughout the school year?
So in order for this to work, teams do have to have scheduled time to work together, but we would sit together in advance and we would say, what do we think some of those really important learning targets and expectations are? And then we would co-create and or review and approve an assessment item by item just to make sure we actually match the standard. One of the first things that happens when we look at published assessments, things we didn't even write, is we quickly realize they don't even match our standards. I have to tell you, Justin, I'm completely convinced at this point that the number one thing the United States could do to improve its standing on the international playing field is to get better assessments to actually match our standards, because right now they don't. So if a team is doing it, we get to push on each other's thinking, like, is that at the right level of proficiency? And is that at the right level of rigor? And do we have the right definition? And will that be enough evidence? So we write that assessment together. And I will tell you honestly that in the beginning, it takes more time to do that. But as you get more skilled and more rehearsed at it, it does go faster. And then we'd give that assessment, we'd come back and we'd start to look at it. And one of the things that I like to talk about when we look at it is not how many kids got how many right. That has been a fatal flaw for us in the field of assessment. So instead, we would really look at the evidence that the students produced and we'd start to talk about what does mastery look like. Can kids get some wrong and still be masterful? And do we have the right definition? In the past 3 weeks, I've been with a number of teams who are frustrated by this notion of using rubrics, because what about subjectivity? Like, I don't want to be held accountable because of my opinion when I'm sitting across from parents. And my response is, let's replace the word subjectivity with the word professional judgment. And then let's talk about where that comes from. Professional judgment isn't just me applying my personal standards. Professional judgment is, if you think about a profession, we come to a shared understanding of like expectations, and then we would examine that work together and come to some place of consistency. So when we're doing this work, to tie back to your earlier question, we begin diagnosing learning, not just counting how many kids got right, and really looking at the evidence to say, what's happening in this kid's mind? Masterful teachers notice thinking, novice teachers notice behaviors. Well, sometimes when we write our assessments to notice behaviors only, we don't get to the thinking part. So we have to rethink how we gather evidence and so on. So our team would do all of that kind of work.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that question of evidence of learning is an absolutely critical one that becomes quite obvious when we look at the new standards, you know, the next gen science standards, the Common Core reading and math standards, and we're starting to see those, or not starting to, but we have for several years now seen those kind of higher order verbs in the standards. And this is why I wanted to talk about Bloom's taxonomy, if you're up for it, because if we think about Bloom's taxonomy with knowledge and comprehension and application and so on, it seems to me that a test, a standardized paper and pencil test with maybe multiple choice questions, maybe there are some written components to that. It seems like the strength of a test like that comes in assessing knowledge and comprehension and maybe application, but standardized tests really, I feel like, struggle to accurately assess students' ability to analyze, synthesize, evaluate, create, all of those higher order tasks. And that is exactly what is specified in our new standards, in the Common Core Math, Common Core Language Arts Standards, Next Gen Science Standards. Those higher order verbs are much less straightforward to assess. And I know you talk in the book a lot about rubrics, but I also know you're not necessarily down on just, you know, tests and quizzes as well. Help us understand assessment when it comes to Bloom's taxonomy and higher order and lower level tasks.
I think our 30-year history of high-stakes testing has driven away some of those higher-order verbs that we know we need to get back to. So I think that the newest versions of standards, whether it's the Common Core or the Next Gen Science or the C3 framework for social studies, all of them are moving us back to that place. And in alignment with that, the new federal legislation for Every Student Succeeds Act, the ESSA Act, in that particular body of information they're saying, or legislation they're saying to schools, we do need different data because we know. So when here's what happens at the state level, at the national level, when policymakers are making decisions, they look for the fastest, most cost-effective, most efficient way to gather information. That's not going to be something that's scored with a rubric. That's going to take a lot more time and money. So if we did a better job of getting our kids to those kinds of thinking on our assessments, they'd be ready for the other kinds of assessments that come along. And how many times do you have to taste a Twix bar before you know what a Twix bar tastes like? We keep saying we need to have kids practice that kind of test taking so they'll be successful. And what Tom, Nicole, and I discovered as we were digging into the research is actually the research says if we teach them only in that kind of a test modality, we don't develop their thinking and they won't be successful on those kinds of tests. So we do need to go back to those bigger verbs of creating and evaluating and synthesizing and analyzing. And more than that, here's the cool conversation that teams get to have. Just in the past, again, 3 months, I've been with so many teams where we don't even agree on what analysis is. If we can't define it and if we can't agree on what it is, how can we teach kids to do it? We've got to get back to that place where we're really bringing those higher order skills back into the conversation and then developing them for kids, not just expecting it of kids, but actually teaching them those process pieces.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that I've seen with Bloom's taxonomy, I don't know if you're seeing this as well, but you know, any good thing has the potential to get distorted in practice, and you know, especially when we try to apply a practice across a large district. I see this especially happening in large districts where Bloom's taxonomy will be recognized as a valuable model for making sure that we're addressing those higher order tasks and higher order cognitive operations and helping students do more interesting work at a deeper level. But I'm hearing some pressure from especially central office administrators on to principals, so pressuring principals to pressure teachers to, and this is the problem here, only do higher order work, you know, and say we have to always be at the very top of Bloom's taxonomy. And I hadn't quite put together what the problem with that was until I came across Natalie Wexler's book, The Knowledge Gap, which came out, I think, earlier this year. And she makes the argument that especially in the elementary school, especially with, you know, in reading, in math, or not so much in math, but in science, social studies, reading, we have largely focused on skills without any content and saying, okay, like we need to teach kids to summarize. We need to teach kids to find the main idea. And what she says is being lost in a lot of elementary schools in particular is actual content knowledge that you can do analysis on, that you can do critical thinking about, that you can do synthesis and finding the author's main idea. And she quotes Dan Willingham as saying, like, you can't think critically about nothing. Like, you have to think critically about something specific. And it's not just, like, we want students to develop transferable skills from that work, but we can't just learn those skills in the abstract. And I think she's kind of lamenting the disappearance of, you know, of science and social studies instruction at the elementary level, especially, you know, since No Child Left Behind, the, you know, the overemphasis on just reading and math, I think has driven that, especially in, you know, higher accountability situations. You know, maybe lower performing schools feel a stronger pressure to abandon science and social studies and really, really focus on reading and math. But she says, you know, we really can't do that because you need the content, you need vocabulary. Bloom's taxonomy requires that foundation, like the foundation of Bloom's, the pyramid is knowledge and comprehension for a reason. So I don't know. What do you think about all that?
You are absolutely right. And it's not just actually at the elementary level. I can't remember the name of the researcher, but last month I came upon another research article that was saying even at the secondary level, we've now made our standards to the extent that teachers get to pick their own curriculum to support that. And there are some critical pieces of knowledge that are being left off the table simply because we're getting to pick whatever we want and we're not getting some really important pieces on the table. So you cannot reason, I agree 100%, you cannot reason without having content. So a masterful teacher, and there's this argument of, can you get to higher level thinking right away, or do you have to always step it down and start here and then move here and then move here? Is there a sequence to this? And the answer is no. And as a teacher, I wouldn't want to fall into a rote pattern. Sometimes if I start with that really robust task, I can pique curiosity and then get them to want the content as it comes along. And sometimes I might need to start with the content pieces to fully develop before we get to, okay, now let's put this all together. My job as the teacher is to make sure I'm getting all the kids to that level, but to then use my content in a way that creates relevance and piques curiosity and makes kids want to continue. Doug Fisher always says, I don't know if people know this, but some of us teach subjects that are completely boring to others. And what I really want is for those kids to fall in love with learning and with our content, and this culture of test, 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 test is killing a love of learning. And kids are walking out saying, I'm done. I want no more of being judged by all of these test numbers. And they're missing the amazing part of math and the fascinating part of science and the intriguing part of history. I mean, it's all so meaningful.
Yeah, and what they're not saying there is, I don't want to do interesting work that can be assessed, right? Like, they're not saying, spare me your interesting assignments and their criteria and your rubrics. Like, I feel like what they're complaining about specifically is the testing for someone else, right? Like, I'm going to take a test. My teacher's never going to see the results except aggregated. I'm never going to see the results. It's not really about any work that I've done or this unit that I've been studying. It's just a test for someone else. And that kind of bad taste in our mouths is being maybe applied to assessment more broadly. I don't know. Do you get pushback on that?
Sometimes I think it's happening right within our schools too. I'm not even going to say it's a secondary phenomenon, but I've sat with so many teams that have said our kids they're disinterested. They'll take the zero, thank you very much. They don't want to even engage in the work, and their zero is no longer threatening enough to require them to do it. So I was in a first grade classroom not long ago, and the teacher was writing a great big, you have 8 out of 15 correct in red marker at the top of the page. And that student had no idea what to do to get better just based on that number. So we've turned assessment into evaluation, and we're using it to judge kids at all levels. And that's the piece that I'm trying to stop. Like, let's become more diagnostic and user-friendly with the information we generate and share.
Yeah, absolutely. And the one of the things that I recall you saying in the book is we have to think very carefully about how we count anything that's intended to be a formative assessment. You know, if we're still developing the skill, it might not make sense to say, okay, we did a formative assessment here and a formative assessment there and then a summative assessment, and then we're just going to average those all together to give you a grade, which is kind of historically what we've done with assignments. What should we be doing instead of that?
Well, so in my world, formative assessment is to help kids improve, and summative assessment proves. So I would want us to have such a healthy formative system that kids got really good information and they could get better between assessments. So we'd have to set up a situation where they would see the same target multiple times and they could track, are they improving, so that by the time they got to the summative, it was just a public celebration of mastery. And a lot of times the number one fear is, wait a minute, are you saying we should just score summatives? But what about the kid who doesn't take a test well? Well, the first thing is, I'm not talking about a normal test. I'm not saying it has to be that kind of a, if we're getting kids into creating and thinking and designing, then that would be something they'd want to get to. And if we used our formative assessments in a healthy way and not just scored points that we would use later to dock against them on the summative, then they would improve and get to that place of this being a big celebration.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's talk a little bit more about the more interesting higher order work that we want students to be able to do. You know, like once we've acknowledged we can't skip vocabulary, we can't skip all facts and content just because they're lower on Bloom's taxonomy and therefore, you know, beneath us or anything. Like we're building the higher order on that foundation of content knowledge and vocabulary and understanding. But you know, obviously we can't just give a quiz to assess something that's higher order. And I look at some of the rubric examples you have in the book, very high quality rubrics for assessing student work or student thinking or, you know, student writing or a project perhaps. At what point or what cognitive tasks are rubrics really good for? Because like, obviously we don't need a four level rubric with four different sub areas to assess vocabulary, right? Like we can give a quiz on vocabulary or, you know, have some fairly straightforward exercises on vocabulary. Where does it really become worth it and helpful to students and valuable to teachers to start to use rubrics as assessment tools?
If it's a binary item, like right or wrong answers, that's not a place to put a rubric. So rubrics are where there's shades of gray, right? And in that particular place, the best way to use a rubric is if I saw it multiple times throughout the year and I had the opportunity to document. The first time I did it, I scored a 2. And the second time I did it, I got a 2. But the third and fourth time, I got a 3. And can I get better over time? And so another key piece to this is making sure that when we have a rubric, even if teachers wrote it together, it doesn't mean we're scoring the same way. So I have been in too many places where we have common assessment data, but we don't actually have common data because we didn't use the scores the right. We didn't score it the same way, even though we wrote the rubric together. So let's take that back into the classroom with kids. Simply handing the kids the rubric and saying, do this, doesn't increase their achievement at all. They have to get to the point where they actually have inner rater reliability with us, the teacher. So a teacher would walk in and they would say, let's look at some samples of work. Let's practice scoring these together. Let's see if we can come to consistency on what these things are. With such frequency that kids develop this clear line of expectation. What's a 1, what's a 2? And when that happens, kids can put themselves in the driver's seat to close their own gaps because they can begin to see what it's really supposed to look like.
And this is that level 4 on Danielson, right? Where students really start to take ownership. It's not just a teacher-driven process, but it really is a student-driven process. And a lot of people look at the Danielson framework and say, okay, I get level 3, but how do you get students to take ownership of this? You know, are they there? Like, do they have the maturity and the knowledge to do that? I think rubrics are a wonderful tool for that. And I think you introduce rubrics partially in the context of vertical alignment, you know, not just horizontal alignment across a team, but vertical alignment and saying, what skills do we want students to develop as thinkers, as learners, and how does that progress from, you know, from year to year as our students spend more time with us, they have more exposure to these expectations and these skills. How do we want that to progress? And I love the way, I think you have a unique gift and experience and expertise in breaking down what I think are kind of abstract cognitive skills, or like we call them skills, but we don't necessarily always understand why they're skills or what the components of them are. I'm looking at page 39 of the book where you have a rubric for summarizing. And you divide summarizing, here's basically what it looks like here, you divide summarizing into topic sentence, summary and details, concluding sentence, and conventions. And just that clarity of like, these are the big elements of writing a summary, I think creates so much clarity for teachers so that they are talking about the same thing, for students so that they know what they're shooting for. And then to use that at the beginning of instruction to, you know, to maybe share some prior work samples and say, hey, look at this kid's work. How did this kid do in terms of the topic sentence and the conventions and all that? Why are these so rare? Like, I learned about rubrics in grad school, in teacher ed program. I don't know that I was the best user of rubrics, but I have to say, I don't see these very much in classrooms. What's going on here with rubrics?
Well, I think, first of all, it's terrifying to think that I would be using subjective opinions to score kids, and I don't want to be accountable to that. And the world is expecting the paper pencil test anyway, and that's objective with right and wrong answers, which is, by the way, not true. That's a misunderstanding about that. But so it's easier and faster, and I'm less worried if I just get answers that are right and wrong. And the other piece that I think is really hard about rubrics is if you take the time to write one, they're time consuming. And if you write a different rubric for every performance task, you're going to be overwhelmed. And worse, you're going to lose the students' ability to improve. So you're better served if you have a couple key rubrics that you use repeatedly all year long. In that way, it becomes far more automatic and easy and consistent. And in that way, kids can actually see the same tool long enough to understand it and get better throughout the different assessments you would use.
So kind of be selective in where we use rubrics for really important things that, you know, that we can revisit throughout the year, maybe even across multiple grade levels. And I appreciate the time point there that, like, there's not really time in the, you know, the busy work week of a teacher to just whip up a rubric every single week or every single day for every single cognitive task that we're asking kids to do, right?
I agree. And the number one thing we could do to save ourselves time, and actually it does save time in the long run, if we could agree on a couple key rubrics that we were going to revisit repeatedly, our kids could go faster through the curriculum after they've learned what that rubric means more deeply. So if we spent time, slower is faster. If we spent time in the fall really helping kids understand those tools and practicing with scoring repeatedly, then in the end, they would actually go more quickly through the curriculum and maybe even add curricular pieces because now they understand what you're looking for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that allows us to get into higher order work more readily. Like once we're clear where we're going with the higher order work, we can also be clearer about what kind of foundational vocabulary and knowledge and understanding, you know, clarify any misconceptions that students need to have cleared up in order to do that, you know, that higher order work. And I want to again go back to this idea that with Bloom's taxonomy, we've popularized the misconception that only the top levels of Bloom's taxonomy are good or that they are rigorous. And certainly we've probably all seen classrooms where everything seems low level, and we definitely perceive that as a lack of rigor, or I don't know if that's really my definition of rigor exactly. But we know it's a problem when it's just all vocabulary. It's drill and kill. It's, you know, your math facts without anything interesting or anything, like no real thinking. It's all just, you know, rote memorization. Like we know if we stop at the base of the pyramid, that's bad. But what I don't think we're recognizing enough is the relationship between those different levels of Bloom's taxonomy, the relationship between knowledge, comprehension, application, and then those higher order tasks of you know, analysis, synthesis, creation, evaluation, that are the fun work, right? And like, and we think about privileged students, maybe students in an honors program, in a gifted program, in an elite private school, at the university level. Like, ideally, we think of students in those kinds of programs as doing mostly that higher order work most of the time. And we feel like there's an equity gap when we see a classroom where everything is low level, everything is worksheets, everything's vocabulary and, you know, rote practice. And we want to kind of bridge that gap. Like it doesn't seem right that the kids who already have the most going for them have access to those higher order learning experiences, and the kids who are struggling the most are stuck down here at the base of Bloom's taxonomy.
There's a team of researchers that calls that the math you, based on the gospel of math, or get poor. Kids get stuck into the grind of, I can do the worksheet at the lower level. It's just going to backspin on them. So those kids, all kids, every child should have access to opportunity and rigorous thinking. And sometimes that's where the passion comes from. So when we take it apart and disaggregate it into its bits and particulars, kids lose interest. And now they're just going to keep sliding backwards on us. So a couple more pieces about that. Number one, you can ask some pretty good thinking questions at the level of comprehension and knowledge. They don't all have to be just recall answers. We can still make kids think with some of those lower level area. And we've got to increase the caliber of our questioning to get kids to think like that. But the other part, recently, I grabbed a book called Moonwalking with Einstein. And in that book, the author suggests that the skill of memorization is really important for absolutely exploding with too many things to remember. And he says we could be using, you know, math facts and vocabulary spelling kinds of concepts by teaching kids different memorization strategies. So it's not just knowledge for the sake of knowledge or procedure for the sake of procedure. It's helping kids understand how to think through and which processes work best for them and what are the different mnemonic devices and so on that we could be using to teach kids how to memorize. So absolutely everything we teach has that opportunity to broaden a kid's world.
Yeah. And I think that's, it's almost like if I were to quote you on that out of context, like people would yell at you on Twitter, probably that that memorization is a 21st century skill. But I think that's absolutely right. That like simply the fact that we can look stuff up doesn't substitute for actually having knowledge in our heads, because we have to have that knowledge in our heads in order to think about it, in order to perform those higher cognitive tasks on it. And I think one of the most common targets of criticism on this point is like dates in history. You know, social studies, oh, back when I learned social studies, it was all just memorizing dates and, you know, none of that is useful anymore. And, you know, I think probably every human in America has had at least one bad social studies teacher. I think that like we have some distaste residual from that. And maybe there was a class where all you did was memorize dates, but you know, historical, you know, issues and events. And, you know, in some cases, the dates do matter. Like you need to know that the Revolutionary War came before the Civil War and that World War I came before World War II. And, you know, like there are aspects of thinking that you simply can't do if you don't know any of that stuff and you have to look it up on Wikipedia before you can even complete a sentence. So,
well, and you can't be a critical thinker or a contributor to a civil conversation if you don't have context and reference, if you don't understand the innuendos and the nuances and the inferences that are being drawn. So today we're going through an impeachment proceeding. And if you don't know anything about impeachment from the previous times that it's happened, that the investigations even took place, then this is all completely out of context for you. And you have a very difficult time engaging in the conversation. So there are things that people just need to know, maybe not all of the nitty-gritty details, because a lot of it can be looked up. But in a moment where you're starting a conversation with me, if I have absolutely no context, I can't participate in an intelligent way.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's especially a powerful point when it comes to addressing gaps and addressing equity. Natalie Wexler makes the argument that a lot of what we have identified as skill gaps, especially in reading, are really knowledge gaps. And if you look at the difference in performance between different schools, it appears that the students in a lower performing school need to have their skills built. And what she's arguing in this book, I think it's a controversial book, but I think an important one for this debate in our society. What she argues is that what looks like a skill gap is really simply in a lot of cases a vocabulary gap that students are able to do higher order reasoning, not because they're smarter and not because they have been taught higher order reasoning, but because they have the vocabulary, the knowledge, the comprehension that is the raw material for that higher order reasoning. And where this has huge equity implications is in how we teach students who are behind, who have some gaps in that knowledge. And she makes a devastating argument against this very skill-focused instruction in her book. It's one that's going to be controversial for a while, I think. But she really attacks this idea that a lot of the things that we call skills are skills that can be taught directly, like the idea that we can just kind of jump to the top of Bloom's taxonomy and teach that higher order skill without that foundation of vocabulary, which is in a lot of cases, we can't do that. And I want your take on this, because as I was re-listening to our podcast, you gave a really insightful example of what the skill of drawing an inference looks like. Do you remember those kind of subcomponents of inference that you mentioned in that podcast? So to what extent is inferring, like we're reading a passage, we're answering questions about it or discussing it, to what extent is inferring a skill versus a function of knowledge?
Well, I would agree with Natalie Wexler that it's that they're so interdependent, right? So there are skills because there are things that I cognitively have to do with that information. I have to draw the explicit information that's in the text. I have to draw the implicit information from my personal story, my schema. I have to put those together and then say, okay, so what's my best guess? What's my good guess about what this means or what could, all of that. And so those pieces do go together. I have to have the content pieces to be able to do in the content at all, and that's problematic. If I happen to be making a good guess, but I'm not backing it with any text, then I'm only relying on my schema. So we have to have kids understand. We have to have teachers understand what is the blend of that. And in the recent past, I've worked with several teams who can't define the difference between an inference and drawing conclusion, or an inference and prediction. And again, until teachers can describe those skills, define those skills, and teach those skills, it's not fair to expect kids to just do it. And I think we have to take it apart and teach those skills because, and I think you're exactly right, Justin, that the kids who already have it, oftentimes they're the kids who have that background knowledge. They live in homes where parents are professionals. They hear that vocabulary. They've had those world travel experiences, and so they've got more to build on, and they're more ready positioned to make some of those best guesses that other kids might be missing. We do have to build both pieces simultaneously.
Yeah, and it's kind of unfashionable to say that like one of the best things we can do for equity is to teach vocabulary and to make kids read a lot and to make sure that everyone has that foundation of knowledge. But as I think about my own experience as a learner, as I think about my older daughter and her proficiency in reading, like almost all of that came from just reading a lot. Like I was never taught any strategies for reading, I don't think, beyond maybe beyond the this letter makes this sound, and just the basic decoding and phonics knowledge. But I think we've taken this charge of pedagogy so seriously, I think especially when it comes to reading instruction, that we think we can teach strategies to overcome a lot of those gaps. And I wonder if based on Natalie Wexler's argument and based on a lot of what we've talked about today, if a lot of the big opportunity that's sitting right under our noses is in the boring stuff that we don't really like, but that we need to do of teaching those teaching those vocabulary, teaching those foundational concepts, not instead of the higher order, working on interesting projects, doing interesting tasks. But so that kids have the foundation. And like I,
With, yeah. So, can I give you a couple examples?
please do, yeah.
So, right now, it's popular in the third grade, especially if you're in Texas or California. Decrepit walls that are crumbling, where people were force-fed a diet of Christianity and asked to believe that, and sometimes not nice things happened. It's real common to make kids memorize all of those details and then talk about, well, where would you build a missionary project today? But number one, they're not going to get to build a missionary project today. And number two, why would we ask them to do something that we believed wasn't necessarily nice back then? So instead, what we would want to do is, while that might be boring content, the truth is there are still ways and places today where people are force feeding you a steady diet and trying to get you to believe something. Like Juul, this is trying to get you to use their cigarettes. That's trying to get you to use flavors. Kids is, let's study this because today that's being used, and then where is it being used today? And if we were to use that power to the good, where we could convince people of something, what would we want to convince our people around us of, and how would we work together to make sure we could get that right work to happen? So relevance matters. If you're trying to get kids to understand that boring stuff, we still need to be relevant with it. The other piece that I would add is, I think kids need to complex text. After grade three, where they're reading to learn, then we need to give them that complex text. And Fisher, Doug Fisher, has a really great strategy for that. He says, you know, put kids into teams and have the range. So let's say we're on a team. Justin is fifth grade and you're on grade level and I'm on second grade level, even though I'm a fifth grader. I'm not reading. You are. And we've got two other people. You would put us together as a team for 2 full weeks, and every day for 5 minutes at the beginning of class, we'd have one paragraph, the same paragraph, and every day we'd do something different. So on day one, we'd just underline, what are all the words we don't know? And on day two, what are the parts of those words, and so on. Because what we want to create is a situation where our EL learners, our special ed learners, our struggling readers and writers are watching good learners struggle productively. So they're developing not only new background knowledge, they're getting new vocabulary, but they're also watching what good learning looks like.
Hmm. Oh, love it. Love it. And I think so many of these dynamics can play out in a really well-designed project-based learning unit. I think some of the schools that are doing the best work in these areas have done the standards work, they've done the formative assessment work, and they're realizing, okay, these are the limitations of our curriculum. Like, there's maybe not a real world component for this. Maybe students just don't really have much of a reason to care about this really important stuff that we want to teach them. And adding that as the driver, you know, the real world, you know, we need to design a plan to clean up this pond in our community, or, you know, something that, you know, that does have a real world connection, that does have some skin in the game for them. Can be a really powerful starting point. Rachel is asking an excellent question here in the live chat. I'm stuck on how to lead teachers to deconstruct the standards, like to start with the standards. It always becomes an argument and a fight of, this is what I do. And I feel like everyone is just stuck on their assessments, that they don't let go and just start at the standard to identify what the standard truly wants them, the students, to show. So she asks, how do we get back to a blank slate when developing success criteria for each standard? Want to speak to that, Cassie?
I do. At the secondary level, it's a little bit easier because when you look at, for example, the Common Core standards, they're bound by grade band. And so the seventh and eighth grade standards are exactly the same. So now we have to talk about the fact that, well, wait a minute, guys, let's just start here because these are the same standards and yet you teach different stuff. So what's proficiency going to look like? But at the elementary level, what I would do is I would take one standard that I knew was difficult, maybe one of the reading standards to support what you've been saying, Justin. And I would say, okay, but let's just make sure that we're all on the same page. Now, in the book that you've been referencing, the Collaborative Common Assessments, I talk about the protocols that you can use to unpack standards. And a lot of times my worry about unpacking standards is teachers do it as an exercise. And it's not really productive. It's just, we're going through this again. The standards are going to change again. So when I try to unpack standards, I do it from the point of what would be the assessment that would go with this. So as we circle the verbs, that decides the method. As we underline parts kids don't know that would require direct instruction, that outlines our formative pathway. As we put stars in boxes around the pieces that would be performance assessments, that delineates where we have to put our criteria for quality and what measurement tools would we put there. So when I try to go through standards, I try to help teachers create meaning by talking about what would it look like if this all got together. And I think one of the dilemmas that we have is we've done a lot of work in our history with unpacking, but we forgot. You actually have to ask teachers to repack and then bundle. They have to put that standard back together again and say, okay, but if the kid did all of this, what would it look like done well? And then because it's too big, what other content do I need to put with this to make it happen? So I'll give you an example right now in math. At fourth grade, there's a standard where kids have to measure liquid, solids, distance, and so on. And so if I unpacked that standard, there'd be 43 different little bullet points because they have to do it in the metric system, the traditional system, and then we got all the bits and particulars. I could create a long, unhealthy test where I ask questions about each one of those, and that's not real for kids. So if I unpack it formatively, let's do a little assessment. Do you understand it with liters? Do you understand it with ounces and so on? But then when it comes to the end, if we were to put that standard together, kids have to be able to walk in and measure in an unfamiliar context. So what's our task going to be? let's say we're going to have kids design the front and the back of a robot meeting these certain specifications, or let's say we're going to have them program a bot that would have to travel this distance in this amount of time and make these turns, and what would that need to look like? So we'd put it all back together, we'd repack it and say, when it's all whole, what's the big product at the end? And then what other content do we need to put in to support kids to be able to do it?
And, you know, teachers might raise the issue that, you know, in that, in that bigger project with the robot, the discrete opportunities to measure, you know, like, are liters going to come up with this robot? I'm not sure if, you know, we might have more use for inches and millimeters, but I think the thing to keep in mind there too is that, you know, robot project does not have to be the only means of assessment. Like, it's still okay for me to give a quiz on, you know, the relationship between millimeters, centimeters, and meters, right? Like, we don't have to throw that out in order to do something more interesting.
No. So as I said, during the formative phases, I'd be checking all those little pieces, because otherwise I can't throw you into the performance and not know you have what it takes. So I have to use those formative pieces to gather that information to get you ready.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Fabulous. Well, I will again refer people to our previous two podcast discussions about collaborative common assessments as well as instructional agility. Let's close, if we could, Cassie, by talking about that concept of instructional agility. Because when we have a good system in place, we have our standards, we have formative assessments, we have summative assessments, you say that allows us to be instructionally agile. What does that mean?
So in order to be agile, I have to be both precise yet flexible. And precision doesn't come from a district mandate. Precision comes from a shared understanding with my colleagues of what that standard looks like and means, and what proficiency is going to look like, so that I know that when I walk into my classroom, I'm getting my kids to the same agreed upon place that we think that standard is requiring of them. And it's when I know that, what that concrete piece is, that when I'm in the middle of it, I can flex and move to still make sure I'm getting there. I like to think about it like a GPS system. Like, you can program, I got to get to North Dakota, and you can program your map to get there, but then you hit roadblocks along the way. This road's under construction, or there's an accident up ahead. Do you want to take an alternate route? That's what happens when you're teaching. Like, we're all going here, but man, six kids didn't get that. Now what do I have to do? So I can't be flexible until I know what true north is. And then I have to have that opportunity to work with you to diagnose learning, to say, okay, so what kinds of mistakes are emerging, and how do I handle it when kids can't infer because they're being explicit, they're being literal? What do I do then? So we would collaboratively solve, like, what do we do when we diagnose learning and it's not perfect? Now what?
Hmm. Well, I know a lot of, absolutely, absolutely. And I know a lot of the face-to-face work that you do with schools and districts is around figuring that out and, you know, developing those, those kind of big picture plans as well as the rubrics. Help us understand how you do help schools directly. So when a school brings you in to work them, or a district team brings you in to work with them, what does that engagement typically look like, or how are you working with them to build that capacity?
Every school is different. Every situation is different. So I like to work with the leaders. And by that, I mean sometimes the teacher leaders and the principal, to talk about where are the teachers and what do they need. Sometimes I'll go in and I'll do a workshop that says, let's just talk about basic assessment literacy. And sometimes I go in for extended periods of time and I sit with teams and we co-create rubrics and we co-create assessments and we look at work and we plan out interventions and extensions. And sometimes I might work with just the ELA or the math team or the fourth grade. And sometimes they'll rotate teams through and they'll say, first hour, you're going to meet with the kindergarten teachers. Second hour, you're going to. So it just varies from one school to the next. But the ultimate goal is to support teachers and students in getting to high levels of success, no matter what format we would use.
Love it. Well, and if people want to get in touch with you and talk about maybe doing some work in their district or school, where's the best place for them to go online to find you?
Well, if you go through Solution Tree, that's where the books are published, and they'll obviously do the booking. I do have a website called Anamcara Consulting. That's the name of my company, Anamcara Consulting. So if I'm doing something that's not tied to PLCs or any of the specific publications through Solution Tree, you could find me there.
Fabulous. Well, Cassie, this has been a privilege for me. Thank you so much for your time and for your engagement in thinking through some of these challenges that we face as a profession and some of the opportunities that are in front of us to improve the way we use assessment as teaching and in the service of learning. So thank you so much for being in the roundtable.
Justin, it's always a thrill to work with you. I love your deep thinking and your great questions. Thanks so much.
All right. And thank you to everyone who joined live and asked questions. And we will post this in our member dashboard shortly. Take care, everybody.